Hello, this is For Art's Sake, a podcast that gives voice to museum people. Here we discover the untold stories, for art's sake and for your sake. We're back with another episode, ready to hear more amazing stories.
Our guest this week is Lizzie Peabody. Lizzie is a storyteller extraordinaire, audio producer, and host of the Smithsonian Institution's wonderful podcast, Side Door. Side Door takes a unique approach to museums and culture, focusing less on the objects themselves and instead on the stories and people behind the Smithsonian's massive collection. Lizzie's journey into the museum world is also pretty special, and we're so excited to discover more about her work today. Lizzie, welcome.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Hello, hello. So Lizzie, before we dive into your background and your work as a storyteller, can you give us a little introduction to Side Door? What is this podcast and how did it come about?
Yeah, so Side Door is the podcast, the flagship podcast for the Smithsonian Institution. And we sneak you in the side door to find stories that can't be told anywhere else. And those span the whole range of 19 museums and research complexes and the National Zoo. A lot of these places you can't even visit on a trip to the National Mall. So it's sort of a way in behind the scenes. And this project got started in 2016. It was actually the idea of the Office of Communications, the Central Office of Communications. The goal was really just to reach new audiences where they were, because a lot of people don't have the opportunity to visit Washington, D.C., and so we wanted people anywhere to be able to hear some of the stories of what goes on here.
What does the Side Door team look like? Because I listen to some episodes and they're just so put together and so enormous in scope that I'm picturing this massive team behind the scenes.
I'm flattered that you think that we're an enormous team. I mean, really, the team is me and producer James Morrison. We are the two full-time producers working on the show. We also have the help of Natalie Boyd, our associate producer, who works 1 to 2 days a week. And then the rest of the team is involved mostly for editorial feedback. So we have two team members at the castle, which is what we call the big, you know, the Smithsonian Institution is at the castle. So they're from the Office of Communications. And they weigh in on all of our editorial meetings and our scripts. And we also have our executive producer at the Smithsonian Enterprises Digital Studio, which I work for. We're kind of like an in-house production company for the Smithsonian. And we also have somebody from the Office of Advancement, and two people, one who weighs in on editorial meetings, one who helps with the newsletter, Tammy and Lara, and they also help with feedback. But in terms of who's making the episode, who's doing the interviews, who's cutting the tape, who's writing the scripts, it's 2.5 of us.
Wow, that's incredible. So for a typical episode, how long does it take you and the team to actually create what we hear?
Oh, okay. So a typical episode is about 30 minutes and it takes, do you want to guess how long it takes?
I'm going to say, I don't want to do that stupid thing of guessing like a ridiculous amount of hours. So the real answer sounds, you know, nothing in comparison, but I'm going to say 30 minutes. I'm going to say 30 hours.
On my side, it was a little bit less. It was around 20. So
20, yeah. No, 100 hours.
What?
It's crazy.
We did the math one time just to sort of, Justin O'Neill, who was senior producer of the show for many years, he sat down and did the math one time. And yeah, for each episode, it's about 100 hours when you think about research, interviewing, transcribing, scripting, cutting, editorial meetings, revision, mixing, mastering music, you know, and then putting it up and you know, even the social media stuff. I don't even think we counted the social media stuff. Yeah, it's 100 hours. And so, and we're working it about on about 3 episodes at a time at a given moment.
Well, I mean, as a listener, thank you for putting in all those hours.
Oh, well, as a producer, thanks for being a listener.
And how do you choose the subjects for each episode? Because there is a lot of variety out there. So how do you decide which stories to tell, which stories not to tell?
So that is a great question. And it really depends. I mean, some of the time, we have, there's an exhibition that's been, you know, 8 years in the making and it's finally opening. And so we really want to find a way to feature some aspect of that exhibition to help further that reach so that more people can learn about it, the fact that it's opening. So that's one way that we get into stories. Another is sometimes we have a curator who will approach us and say, I've been working on this research about this mysterious person I've discovered from history, and I think that they would make a great candidate for a side door story. And we love those internal pitches, especially when it's somebody who's already done so much primary research, who knows so much about the subject. Other times, it's just us saying, wow, we really haven't featured this museum in a while. We would love to do a story with them. Let's get on their website and poke around and see what they have going on. So it really depends. We get stories all sorts of ways. Oh, and occasionally listeners write in with an example or with an idea. And that's always very exciting.
Do you have any favorite episodes, any stories that you've worked on, anything you then look back at and go, wow, that was a really good one?
Oh, man. I had a feeling you were going to ask that question. It's so hard because there's so many different kinds of stories. And I mean, there are definitely some that I feel especially proud of. I mean, one of my favorites is Apollo 12's very close call. Apollo 12 being sort of like the middle child of the Apollo missions that people don't really pay attention to, but was so exciting. And I loved that story just because it was a fun yarn to spin. It had great characters. It had high drama in space. You know, when you're hurtling through space and all of your electrical equipment goes down and you don't know why, I mean, that's the definition of drama. So that was a really fun story to tell. You know, there's stories that have been really challenging, like one we did last season on, it's called Reservation Mathematics. It was about basically the history of blood quantum, this notion that, you know, I have half Cherokee blood and a quarter Irish blood or whatever, this idea of dividing up your blood, where that comes from and how it really is a tool of colonialism that exists to exploit Native peoples and Indigenous peoples and is carried forward today in really interesting ways that continue to impact those communities. Telling that story was really challenging because I am not a member of a Native community, and so telling a story about a community you're not a part of carries a lot of weight, especially, you know, when you're approaching it from this sort of institutional standpoint. But we were able to really get into that story in a way that felt good, by way of an artist who was photographing members of her family and as a way to tell the story of blood quantum. So we really worked with her, and she interviewed members of her family, and we were able to use those stories, you know, via her and her photography work and really get into this fascinating, gnarly, thorny history. So that was a really, really challenging story to tell, but one that I'm very proud of the fact that we did it. And then there's just, oh my gosh, the one on leeches. You know, I do have this fear, or I should say I did have a terrible fear of leeches. And, you know, for this story, I had to go stand in a swamp and let leeches bite me. And that was, I mean, that got my blood going. So, I mean, that was one of my favorite ones to record, really, because I like to be a little bit scared most of the time. Okay, not most of the time, some of the time. This is 2022. I like to be a little scared some of the time.
I think the episode on leeches, which I think was called Bloodsuckers! Mark, that was a fantastic one. I think the thing that always gets me with Side Door is there is such variety in the episodes. There are those really serious, really hard-hitting stories, but then, yeah, you have the ones that are a bit weird, a bit out there. I think that's one of the key strengths that keeps me, as a listener, really excited week after week.
I'm glad to hear that. Weird and out there is what we go for.
And we'd like to ask about you. Now, correct us if we're wrong, but you're not a typical museum person, are you? Can you talk to us a little bit about your professional background and how you became a professional storyteller?
Sure, yes. I am not a museum person, I guess, as you say. I did not start off working in museums. I started off as a classroom teacher. I worked as a teacher for the first 4 years out of college. And so by the age of 27, I was working as a kindergarten teacher. And I had found at that point that, you know, storytelling was a really, really good tool to capture and keep the attention of five-year-olds. And at that age, it's like there's really no convincing anyone to listen to you unless you convince them that they're interested in what you want them to be interested in. So it's all about the subtle art of manipulation and making yourself as entertaining as possible. So storytelling was a really valuable tool in my toolbox. But by that time, I kind of hit a wall in my life. I think it's kind of common. The more people I talk to, 27 sounds like an age where a lot of people sort of take stock and make changes, you know, if they have the ability to. And so at that point, I really felt like every day kind of felt the same. I knew what to expect. I was with the same guy I'd been dating since freshman year of college, you know, 8 years before. And I just felt so stagnant. So I took one improv comedy class and decided I could just throw all the cards in the air and justify my choice later. The dangers of improvisational comedy. And so I did. I walked away from my teaching job and I walked away from my relationship. And I thought if I could really do anything, and I turned off all of the voices that say, it's too late, you're too old, you don't know how, I would try to tell audio stories. And I had no idea how to do it. So I had been interviewing family members and friends for years, I realized, fellow teachers. So I had some interviews I'd collected, and I started trying to teach myself audio editing via YouTube and free online software and my phone. I just had my voice memos app on my iPhone. Anyone can do it. But I'm a perfectionist. So like I felt like I was waiting for the perfect, foolproof, bulletproof story that, you know, nobody could say anything bad about ever. And, you know, then I could really start being an audio producer. But surprise there, that story doesn't exist. And I wasn't actually making anything. So I made a New Year's resolution that year. I was like working as a barista for health insurance and kind of chugging along and doing volunteer gigs and trying to learn whatever I could. But I thought, okay, I'm going to do an interview every single day with a stranger, because even if I suck at this now, by the end of the year, I will have enough hours of interviewing and I will be good at going up to strangers and ask if I can talk to them. I will be sure to be at least a little better than I am now. And so I did that, and that grew into a show I produced called Your Story Here, which is basically just me learning how to do the thing. And local small podcast network distributed that. And then I started to get freelance gigs, and then I started freelancing for the Smithsonian, and I eventually came on as a full-time producer and then the host. And that was probably a longer version of that story than you needed to hear, but I haven't thought about it in a little while. And I think I'll say that the connection for me between teaching and podcasting really is storytelling. It's all about, can I effectively communicate something in a way that will capture and hold a listener's attention?
That's really, and honestly, to me, a very inspiring story. I was a teacher too. And at the age of around 27, I used to teach high school history. And you say that storytelling is a great way to keep the attention of five-year-olds. It works pretty well for 15-year-olds as well.
And works for around everyone.
It works for everyone. And around the age of 27, I also started to feel a little bit stagnated and took this kind of leap of faith to move into museum and heritage education. So it's really nice to hear that these things can pan out, because I also have those voices telling me, you're too old, just stick with the thing. And I still have those days where I'm like, that was a terrible decision. I could have been, you know, comfortably racking up my teacher's pension at this point. But no, it's nice to know that those leaps of faith do pay off.
Yeah. Oh, and I'll add, you know, I was fortunate that I had a safety net that I didn't need to use, thankfully, but I knew that, you know, I had family I could call on if I ever couldn't make rent. So I recognize that it's not a risk everyone can afford to take. So, you know, I had a lot going for me in that regard.
Now, I'm sure listening to that, there are going to be some listeners who are unsure of what a professional storyteller even is, or even thinking of storytelling as an art form. What does storytelling mean to you, and why do you think it's so valuable?
So there's so many different kinds of stories, and therefore a lot of different kinds of storytelling. I think what's helpful, I mean, so there's first-person storytelling, and that is a kind of storytelling I've spent time teaching here in the D.C. area, formerly with an organization called Story District. And those are really true stories from your life about something that happened to you. And I don't know if your listeners are familiar with The Moth. It's very much that kind of storytelling. And, you know, 5 to 10 minutes, often performed on stage. So I've done a fair amount of that. And I think that the magic of stories like that is that it can feel very self-indulgent to kind of get up on stage and grab the microphone and say, all right, here's something about me that all of you need to know. But when it's done well, honestly, it's kind of the closest you get to feeling what it might be like to be someone other than yourself. And if it's done in a real authentic way that is sort of revealing of yourself and your fears and your desires and what's motivating you at this moment in your life that the story takes place, it's an incredibly generous thing to do, because you'll find so many of our impulses are universal in that way. So the more specific you get about your life and the more honest you can get, I think the more resonance it has for more people. So storytelling is a great way. I mean, in the DC community, I've seen how it builds community. So I love that kind of true first-person storytelling. Now, that's a little different from what we do on Side Door, because we're obviously, I'm not telling stories about myself most of the time. But the principles hold true. And I would say the specificity, that holds true. The more specific you can get, the more universal appeal a story has. The other thing that a story really needs is strong characters. So maybe you're not the main character, but the story needs to have vibrant characters. Ideally, it needs to be somewhat scenic. You know, it needs to have strong, vivid images. It absolutely needs action. Something has to happen in your story for it to be a story. And the main thing that it needs is a reason to care. And in the storytelling world, we call that stakes, sort of a reason for a listener to care what happens to this person or in this tale. And so in the museum space, I work a lot with curators and researchers who are experts in their field, and they know so much. But often they'll come to us at Side Door with an idea and say, I have a story for you. And then they'll say, it's about, you know what? I don't want to give an example because I don't want to out anybody. But they'll say, I have a story for you. And then they'll give me not a story, but a topic, like a general period of history or like a subject, like leeches. Leeches is not a story. That is a topic. So you really have to find the story within the topic. A topic is general. A story is specific. So I don't know. That was, does that answer your question?
To me, absolutely. And as a storyteller, both on Side Door and your other network, what are some challenges you come up against and how do you overcome those challenges?
How do I count them? There's so many challenges. You know, I think the most consistent challenge I run into, and maybe it's at the top of my mind because, you know, right after this, I have to hop into an editorial meeting on a script I just wrote that I know is too long. And the challenge is really taking a wealth of information and really chiseling it down to a tight story with a beginning, a middle, and an end. And it can feel especially hard because, you know, you go out there and you talk with multiple experts and, you know, people with personal connections to this story, and they've all got a lot to say about it. And sometimes my job as a producer is to be the advocate of the listener. So I'm taking all this information and all these specifics and sometimes a whole huge swath of history, and I have to decide, this is important enough to say, this is not important enough. This stays, this goes. And those decisions are just hard every time. I feel like it doesn't really get easier because you feel like you need to represent the work of the people who are trusting you with this information and with this story. But you also really need to look out for the listener. And you know, if you're telling something, if you get into the weeds and you spend too long describing this random thing nobody understands, like no one's going to want to listen to that. So you really have to toe the line between respecting the authority of the experts and dumbing it down enough to be interesting to normal people like me. So I have to be really honest with myself when I'm writing something. And if I'm bored, I have to assume everyone else is going to be bored too. So that's a challenge for sure. So I'd say there's three main kinds of stories we tell. One is character-driven stories. So you have a central character that did something remarkable and changed something, the world. And so like a good example of that might be Lena Richard, America's unknown celebrity chef. Here you have this extraordinary character that not many people know about. It's tied to an exhibition at the museum, and it features this primary research of a museum curator, Ashley Rose Young. So that's a great character-driven story. The challenge is that life is long. Any one person's life, if you tell it from start to end, it can begin to feel like sort of a TikTok, right? You have to figure out the contours. Like, where do we begin? Do we begin when she's born? Do we begin when she gets sent off to culinary school? Where do you start the story? What is at stake? You know, what are the challenges and what is the climax? So figuring out, like, what section of life to really dig into and, like I said, get into those specifics. So if you think of, like, I don't know, a life is this long timeline. It's like, where are you going to put the brackets on that and, like, really zero in on that life? The other challenge often with character-driven stories, especially from history, is there's no record of their voice. So for Lena Richard, we ended up reaching out to modern-day New Orleans chef of color who knew the story of Lena Richard and really admired her, and we got her to read Lena Richard's letters. So that was a way around that. These days, COVID is a pretty big challenge. So, you know, we couldn't go to the museum. And so in this case, what we did was we sort of brought Lena Richard's granddaughter to my kitchen sonically, and I cooked one of her recipes while on the phone with her granddaughter. So my kitchen became this sort of like scenic space you could go to because we didn't have a place in the museum that we could go to. So those are some challenges with the character-driven stories, I'd say. Another kind of story we often tell, I sort of call history of a moment, and that's telling a story that leads to a big moment of fear or tension or change. Like, the story builds up to this moment and then a situation is resolved. So an example of that might be Outer Space and Underwear, the time that an underwear company beat out a bunch of military industrial contractors to manufacture the first walking spacesuit to be worn on the moon. So it's, again, figuring out where to start the story, where to end the story, which characters are important enough to, like, build out and flesh out and get into their backstory. Where do you put the focus, I'd say, is a big one. And then we have the third kind of story is, like, the single interview. So these are stories that we tell because we think they're going to be easy, and they never are. I feel like we're always looking for the single voice story because basically you have one interview and you can write the whole episode around that one interview. But really all that means is you need all of the tension of a narrative arc to exist in this one conversation you have with a person. So you got to plan the interview really well, and then you have to edit it really smartly. You guys do this every time. Like, this is what you're doing right now with your show. Right? Like,
we're trying.
Yeah. So an example of that would be like Adam Rippon, this Olympic figure skater. So we had, okay, Adam Rippon, he's this famous guy. He's coming to the Smithsonian. We need to interview him. So then figuring out what is the story that he can tell us. That's a challenge. Fred Tutman, the river keeper, had a great interview with him. Lonnie Bunch, the Secretary of the Smithsonian, had a great interview with him. These are all episodes that it just sort of rest on the shoulders of one interview. Oh, Pete Mara, this ornithologist, just like went walking in the woods with him talking about birds. But no one wants to listen to like 25 minutes of like, there's a sparrow, there's a woodpecker. You can't see it anyway. So we had to think, okay, what is the story here? Building the narrative arc into the interview of like, birds are disappearing. Why are they disappearing? Where are they going to? What does it mean for us all in the course of this walking around and observing birds? I feel like I just talked for a very long time. Those are some of our challenges, I'd say.
Thank you so much for that really in-depth answer there. And I think also for me, the listeners won't be able to see this, but I'm sitting here nodding like a madman as you're reminiscing about these episodes, because to me, it's just great to see the curtain pulled back on some of these stories that I remember really, really fondly.
Oh, thanks.
So obviously this is a podcast with museum people. We've talked a little bit about the museum. We've talked a little bit about the person. So let's bring those two together. So to us, the work that Sidedoor does, the work that you do as a storyteller is really, really important in terms of opening up museums to new audiences. What do you think it is about the podcast that helps the Smithsonian to engage new people?
I think it's partly just a different platform. And, you know, podcast listeners demographically fall into a different category than, I mean, certainly there's a lot of overlap in the Venn diagram, but you're going to reach different people via a podcast than you will via an online panel discussion or a press release or an exhibition in person at the museum. So part of it is just reaching new audiences. I think also, you know, museums, people tend to think of museums as being a place where that you go to look at things. And that's true. There's so much to see in our 19 different museums and the zoo. But there's a lot more than that, too. And there's a lot of resources at the Smithsonian that don't necessarily lend themselves to visual display. There's a lot of oral histories, and there's a lot of stories that whatever the visual element is, only hints at what's really behind it. So I feel like the podcast is a great opportunity to take any one item out of millions of items and just go really, really deep and tell the whole story behind it. And, you know, when you visit the museum, you're moving fast. There's a lot of stuff to see. I don't know about you guys, but my classic blunder is I'll go in all fresh-faced and ready to learn, and then I get, you know, I spend an hour and a half in the first room just, like, reading every word on every plaque and, like, trying to connect it to, you know, trying to flesh out my own internal timeline. And then by room two, I'm, like, exhausted, and then I have to do the whole other three floors of the museum in about 20 minutes, like a sort of a whiz whirlwind. Like, museum fatigue is a real thing, so the podcast does a little of that work for you. It's like, we're just gonna tell you what to pay attention to this time. And here's 30 minutes of this one story. So I think that's helpful. And the last thing I'll say is podcasting is a surprisingly visual medium. I mean, you know that if you've heard a book on tape, you have images in your head that go with those characters, and you have a full world that exists in your imagination. So when you see the movie after, it often is kind of disappointing. And podcasting is the same. So much of these stories happen at another moment in time. And I think it really enables you to form a connection with the characters and to form your own visuals. I mean, if we do our job right and help that along enough, in a way that lands just as strongly as seeing the thing in real life.
I'm so glad you brought up museum fatigue, because I thought that was just me and I thought I was doing museums wrong. But no, it's definitely a real thing.
Oh my gosh. I feel so like I'm outing myself talking to the museum experts about how bad I am at actually visiting museums. But there you go.
But yeah, it wasn't until like I studied museum education that I was like, oh, okay, there's a better way of doing this than going around and obsessively reading every single thing. So yeah, that's good to hear. I'm not alone.
I feel like those of us who were like, students who really cared about our grades are especially more, I don't know, more likely to fall prey to that. I must read every word. I need an A.
So you mentioned that there's a kind of a different audience for podcasts than there is for museum visitorship. Have you found that new audience, that podcast audience, has had any kind of impact on the way that the Smithsonian museums actually plan out exhibitions or try to appeal to their visitor base?
That's a hard thing to measure. As you know, right, when you make a podcast, you broadcast it out into the ether and you hope someone is listening, but there are limited ways to know, really, what people are doing with that information. We have some metrics, you know, we can tell from download numbers and sort of the steady growth that more and more people are listening, and it's a very positive trajectory. So we know that we're reaching a lot of people. We also have a newsletter that we send out that accompanies each episode, and we can tell based on how many people click and what they click on and whether they become donors and things like that, how people are engaging with the rest of the institution, and that's very positive too. And then we've seen the growth of other podcasting projects at specific museums and units, and that's really encouraging to see too. So I think between sort of listener engagement and the growth of other audio storytelling initiatives across the Smithsonian, that I would say that is sort of the impact we've seen. And the last thing I'll say is we have occasionally sent out surveys to listeners. And one thing that really surprised me is the percentage of our listeners who have never visited the Smithsonian. So we know there are a lot of people listening who've never been to DC, who've never been to a Smithsonian museum. And that is really cool to see.
Yeah, me being one of them.
Yeah, I'm one of those. So,
oh yeah, my gosh. Well, come, I'll take you.
So I think that having this very open, very behind the scenes look at the Smithsonian's collection is a real step in the right direction in terms of breaking down some of the elitism we often associate with museums. And for you, as a kind of non-traditional museum person, how has working on the podcast changed how you view the Smithsonian or museums in general?
Well, I'll say this, and I promise no one is paying me to say this. You know, I have so much more appreciation for what the Smithsonian does, having worked for the Smithsonian. I didn't know before I took this job just how much research, active research, goes on at the Smithsonian, and an active, like, cultural heritage preservation, things like that. I mean, there are people working in Ukraine right now from the Smithsonian working to try to protect cultural heritage from destruction. We've had people in Haiti, in Iraq. And that, I mean, when you're training with the FBI to go in and try to, like, save art, I mean, that's kind of heroic. It's like, I didn't know that. And that's really cool. And I also just think, you know, learning the story of the founding of the Smithsonian, how it really was this bequest for the increase and diffusion of knowledge, right? You know, to build knowledge and to spread it. And I really can't think of a cause more worthy of that, especially today. So I'm sort of in a, you know, when you're in a relationship and there's different periods of, like, you know, you just sort of take things for granted and you're bumping along and you're making breakfast and you're sort of, like, talking about the weather. And then then there's moments where you're like, it's really, you know, you're super in love all over again. I'm kind of super in love all over again with the Smithsonian right now. I'm just really impressed with the range of things that this institution does. And as a former teacher, the dedication to education. I think that as a non-museum person, I feel like that's the thing that actually equips me to do this job of hosting the show. I think that, you know, the thing that makes me, I think, a decent host is the fact that I'm fairly unremarkable. You know, I don't really have I'm sort of a generalist. I'm kind of interested in most things, but not super interested in any one thing. I don't have an area of expertise myself. And so I sort of have to trust that my reaction to whatever I'm seeing or hearing is going to be more or less what anyone else's reaction is likely to be. So sort of trusting my instincts on that front. I think the fact that I am sort of the everyman, the sort of the unremarkable person, is what makes me a good audience stand-in. So when I have those moments of, like, what the heck am I doing here? I don't belong here. I know nothing. That's what I fall back on, is it's sort of my job to know nothing, but to be interested in everything. And so I think it works.
Your answer is so beautiful, and it's honesty.
And I think if there's one thing we can say, it definitely, definitely works.
It definitely.
Thanks.
Are there any lessons you think museums around the world, or more specifically in the US, could learn from the Smithsonian and Side Door as a project?
The thing I've learned from working on Side Door is what it takes to create a professional quality and consistent show from an educational nonprofit institution. And, you know, as far as nonprofits go, I mean, the Smithsonian being willing to put the time, energy, and money behind a show like this, it's really rare in the nonprofit world. And especially, I know it's not easy. So it really takes, I'd say that, you know, for a museum that is trying to make a production like Side Door, you know, you really just, you want to invest. You have to invest in the quality of the show and trust that the educational reach it has is worth the lift, because it is kind of a leap of faith. And I'd say we're really, really fortunate that we have that internal buy-in in leadership at the Smithsonian. There's that commitment to education that really makes us able to make this podcast.
And are there any museums or cultural institutions you are aware of who have similar projects that you think deserve a bit of recognition?
The Smithsonian has other shows. Let me just plug all the Smithsonian stuff. There's Portraits, which is out of the National Portrait Gallery, and that's wonderful. We sometimes guest feature episodes of Portraits. And there's also Airspace. Shout out to my friends at Airspace at the National Air and Space Museum. I used to work on that show, and that is a really fun show, too. They're each a little different in their format, but they are great museum podcasts. And then the National Museum of American History just put out a limited series podcast called Collected about Black feminism. And that one is going to be excellent as well.
Thank you.
Awesome. Those sound great. Just a few final questions before we let you go today, Lizzie. Do you have any upcoming projects or stories that you're excited about? Anything you can tell us or maybe allude to vaguely?
Yeah, we're about to wrap up this season. And for our last episode of the season, we're trying something a little different because some of the listener feedback that we consistently get and never listen to is that they want to know more about the Smithsonian itself, you know, its collections and how we do what we do and all of that. And that's sort of a guiding principle of ours not to do. We try to tell stories from the Smithsonian, not about the Smithsonian. But our last episode of this season is going to be about the Smithsonian, and in particular, our very unusual story of how this whole party got started. And it begins with this 200-year-old document that showed up on the Smithsonian archives, wrapped up in a Chelsea Flower Market bag. Nobody knew what it was. It was dusty and old. And we unfolded it, and it turned out to contain this just masterpiece theater level of drama, family drama, that kind of caused us to better understand the whole founding of the Smithsonian. So I'll tease it with that. That's a story that we're going to tell at the end of this season.
That's
and then
really
we'll be brewing
intriguing.
Up a whole new set for season 8.
Looking forward to listening. And Lizzie, we have a question we ask absolutely everyone. If you had unlimited funds, what kind of museum or cultural project, rather, would you create?
Okay, well, I'll tell you this thing I've been thinking about. If I had unlimited funds, I think I would start the Smithsonian Center for Storytelling. And it would be all about how to just tell kick-ass stories, and we could do workshops and consulting and work with other museums and work with Smithsonian units and just get everyone in there telling their own stories, and then so that they were better equipped and knew more about how to tell museum stories, because it's just so much fun. And I think everyone could benefit from learning more about, you know, the fundamentals of narrative.
I really like the sound of that. I would definitely visit the Smithsonian Center of Storytelling. That would be my first visit as I landed in D.C.
Me too.
It would probably be more like a behind the scenes, like it's like the behind the curtain of the behind the curtain. Maybe to go to the Smithsonian Center for it would be open to all. Never mind.
Where can we find more about you type questions? So you can mention social media and Smithsonian websites and stuff like that, if you want to throw that one at the end there.
Oh, yeah. You can find us on social media, Twitter and Instagram, at SideDoorPod, all one word. And you can also write us an email. Our email address is sidedoor@si.edu. And you can visit our website to see all of our back catalog of shows, and that's si.edu/sidedoor.
Okay, Lizzie, thank you so much once again for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a real pleasure to talk with you all.
We hope you've enjoyed this week's episode of For Art's Sake. If you'd like to learn more about who we are and what we do, find us online at forartsake.co.uk, on Twitter @sake_arts, or on Instagram @forartsake.uk.